Our fifth case for this morning is Wade v. Collier. Mr. Horwitz?
Is there a button I press here?
Yes, the button's down there. And it'll go up until you press it again, then it'll stop.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Blake Horwitz on behalf of Crop Papers and the plaintiff appellate. So I'd like to give a little bit of background before I go into the reason why I believe that the court committed error in the ruling and summary judgment. First of all, what we have in this situation is a very, very large investigation that was taken place by the defendants. Okay, they spent about $1 million, tremendous amount of manpower, more manpower than any other operation, undercover operation they performed. And they basically hadn't captured anybody, except for three guys. Now,
your opponents actually questioned that, but since time is short, I think it would be best to focus on your brief makes three arguments. One is your classic one argument, one is or maybe it's even just two arguments. You know, are there genuine facts for the malicious prosecution claim? And we have come close following Enquist to say that there just can't be a class of one argument if what you're talking about is an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, because that's just inherently such a discretionary activity, if you will, such a set of discretionary choices, that to meet the standards of Village of Willowbrook against Olek or whatever case you want to pick, you're not going to be able to show that they moved ahead without a rational basis. So what's your response to Enquist and that line?
Well, I think that there's been no Seventh Circuit opinion that I've seen.
Yeah, but Enquist is from the Supreme Court, so that's why I'm kind of moving it up a notch.
I do not think Enquist ruled that if you want to coin the phrase selective prosecution or a class of one claims, that Enquist ruled that there cannot be a selective prosecution slash class of one claim with regards to a prosecution.
But we have said now, following Enquist, we've said, well, the Supreme Court was worried in Enquist about discretionary decision-making, as it put it, based on a vast array of subjective individualized assessments. And then in a case called United States against Moore, we said prosecutorial discretion is that kind of decision.
I think in this scenario, analogous to the malicious prosecution scenario, where officers just come and lie and blatantly lie to state's attorneys, and they take those lies and they put...
Yeah, but it's just malicious prosecution, right? I don't know what you get by adding a class of one. That's your charge, right? Malicious prosecution.
There are two. And we do believe that there are two charges, and we do believe the malicious prosecution.
I don't understand why this is not a standard malicious prosecution case, and I don't see what is added by talking about classes of one.
Well, because I think that my client was treated differently, and I think that the
yes,
court...
I know, but your complaint is malicious prosecution. That's what you're complaining about, isn't it?
It is two things. If Your Honor is saying...
Well, is the notion that you can have malicious prosecution without malice, is that your argument, by calling it a class of one?
No.
Well, if you require the elements of malicious prosecution also for your class of one claim, what does the class of one claim add?
I do not think that the class of one requires malicious prosecution as an element. I think the Ninth Circuit...
Well, what's left?
That...
You mean just they accidentally prosecute or they...
No.
They pick out, maybe they just flip a coin, and they pick out someone to prosecute because, you know, big conspiracy, they just pick on one person, not worth, and that for you would be a violation of the Constitution?
No, that's not our claim. So
I mean,
what Your Honor has articulated is a claim.
We've talked about this, you know, with police officers who make arbitrary judgments whom to stop for speeding. That's
right. That's correct. That's Enquist. Right, and that's not what I'm arguing.
Okay, but what you're going to argue is you're going to add the element of malice to try to take it out of the discretionary prosecution.
No, that's not what I'm arguing. Malice is not a requirement, as Your
Honor.
What
is the requirement?
Well, it's, as Your Honor has written in other opinions with regards to equal protection class of one, it is either no rational basis or animus. And there's no decision yet by the Seventh Circuit.
Well, what's the difference? What, animus? What's the difference?
It's either animus.
Well, Willebrook left it open. What's the difference between animus and malice?
Well, malice in the Illinois...
And if they have no rational basis, it must be that it was improper motive, right?
Malice in the state court... Judge, I'll answer the question.
What are you fussing about?
Malice does not have to be the ill will. Malice does not have to be the ill will,
Judge. The point is it whether it's an improper prosecution, not just a discretionary judgment, but something improper about it. No?
No.
No?
Right.
All right.
So whether or not you believe I'm right or wrong, I think that
sure
if police officers... Okay. Well, I think if police officers lie to state's attorneys, the action's not against the state's attorney, the action's against police officers. Here we have officers...
But see, there you do... You know, I don't think you're confronting Enquist, but I think for the time being, I'm going to assume that you're talking about your second theory, which is your malicious prosecution theory. It's a supplemental claim. But the state courts found that there was probable cause.
No, they did not.
Yes, they did.
No, they did not. The state court found there was probable cause for, well, I apologize. The state court found there was probable cause for arrest. That's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
But and the state court also found there's probable cause to search my client's home, just to be clear about what happened below.
Right,
but,
so they find there's probable cause, and then he's vindicated, if you will. He's acquitted.
But it's not that simple. The mere fact that the state court, if anybody, any police officers say, I am now, my hands are now washed because I go to a judge with a false affidavit and false information, my hands are now washed, I'm vindicated, I now have immunity. That's not how it is. If you, and the Supreme Court is well stated on this, that if the police officers make false misrepresentations, which proximately cause, you can call it substantial contributing factor, or whatever you like with regards to the level
false,
of proximate cause.
When you say false, do you mean deliberately false or
yes.
mistaken?
No.
Yeah, I mean, we have
well,
cases...
that's malicious prosecution. That
it is malicious prosecution.
Judge, I'm happy...
It's defeated by a finding that there was probable cause to go forward with the prosecution.
Not,
it is. In Illinois, that is an element, no probable cause.
The Supreme Court has stated that if false information is presented to a judge, upon which the judge makes a decision to sustain for the moment in a preliminary hearing or however proceeds.
But you're assuming that the probable cause comes from the false information. And there's, you know, probable cause is one of these many totality of circumstances inquiries. And I, you know, I just... don't see how you can get around the fact that the state prosecution went forward based on probable cause, a grand jury indicts, you know, all sorts
right.
of things happen.
Well, so if based upon that logic, every time a grand jury indicts, in any case where a grand jury indicts, everybody's sanitized because a state's attorney that we sometimes don't trust the government, a state's attorney wants to present whatever he wants to present without any cross-examination to a grand jury who knows nothing about a case. And a cop gets up on the witness stand and says whatever he wants to say, and a grand jury now sanitizes it. Now we have no more malicious prosecution cases. So let's take our weakest cases, all of our cases, let's get them in front of a grand jury. Now there's no more malicious prosecution
well,
no, cases.
What is
I didn't make up the elements of the malicious
but that,
prosecution
but that's not the law,
cause
Judge.
Of action. It, they are that there has to be an absence of probable cause. And we all know that probable cause is a standard that isn't a preponderance of the evidence or whatever. It's enough cause to go forward. And you may not like this, but the absence of probable cause is an element. So if we forget entirely, there's tons of probable cause in this case to go forward with this case, even if in the final analysis, if you will, the system works. You know, he's acquitted, he's had his hearing, and he persuades a trier of fact that he did not commit any wrongdoing. I mean, it's...
Judge, if you've decided that there's probable cause, and I cannot convince you otherwise, I don't know what else to say, other than there are false documents, that which is what gave rise
but
to...
But his relations with Thurston were suspicious.
Suspicious, fine. Suspicion's okay.
Well,
no, suspicion's great. You know, we know about suspicion
cause.
And what to do with suspicion. That's not probable cause.
That's
And we all know that they're separate elements. Judge, the mere fact they're suspicion, there's no independent other than...
No, I didn't say... No. Suspicious dealings with Thurston.
Okay.
Suspicious. Not that there were... Suspicion is different from being suspicious. But the kind of relations he had with Thurston, tipping him off and so on, it could be, as I guess the jury concluded, it could be, you know, he's just trying to befriend him so he'll get information from him. It's a deal. It's fine. Okay, that's fine. But on the other hand, it certainly looked questionable that he's, you know, giving police information to a criminal. So it ends up in a prosecution.
The only way that we can come to that conclusion is if we accept as a matter of law that those are the facts and there is no question of fact about whether or not he tipped him off to anything.
No, that's not true. All you need is the suspicious circumstances creating probable cause for the prosecution.
What I'm saying is the facts that you just related, Your Honor, if those are the facts...
Well, it's the telephone calls that were recorded. We know what they are.
The mere existence of telephone calls with officers means two things. Number one, it means he's doing a great job developing relationships with street contacts and individuals so that he can ferret out crime. He's being a great cop. By the way, he was only a very good cop before this. And he interestingly filed a lawsuit 4 months or 5 months before he was arrested. Interestingly.
All right, you're going to need to wrap up now.
All right. And then just secondly, the fact that there's something wrong with that communication, the purported December 9th communication to Hosey Thurman, is only made wrong by one person who said, I in essence told Wade in the lineup.
Oh, okay. I think we have your point. We certainly have your brief. So thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Rewberry.
Mr. Calcaterra represents Mr. Wheeler, in case you have any questions with respect to the claims against Mr. Wheeler.
Okay,
separate counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good afternoon. I represent defendants Collier and Mobley. This case basically oozes probable cause from every pore. There's not only the telephone calls, there's also Mr. Thurman's testimony, as Judge Posner alluded to. Mr. Thurman gave extensive testimony at the criminal trial describing how the two of these individuals operated what amounted to a criminal operation, a criminal enterprise, whereby Mr. Wade would use his office, his gun, and his authority to rip off other drug dealers, and the two of them profited from that. Mr. Thurman described that in great detail.
So Mr. Horwitz argues strongly that the state courts didn't find probable cause to go forward with this prosecution.
Well, let's see. There was an arrest warrant, a search warrant. Oh, and there were the two Franks hearings, by the way. There was the Franks hearing, the first one he had where...
And doesn't that focus on all this backdating and forward dating of the memo about the roll call?
It does.
December 9th or 13th or whatever.
It does. And that is, as the district court pointed out, that is the entirety of his case. And the thing is, you know, we're forgetting something here. I know I am. Those memoranda were not evidence, at least not admissible. It's hearsay. It's a prior consistent statement. And it's a prior consistent statement that's only admissible if allegations of recent fabrication were made. And that never occurred. And in fact, those memoranda, I mean, I talked to a criminal defense attorney. I know I had lunch with him. I described these memoranda. He began salivating. And his main course had not been brought to him. I mean, that was great cross-examination material for the defense. So the idea that these memoranda somehow resulted in this guy being wrongfully prosecuted, those memoranda were a problem for the prosecution. They were properly disclosed, and they were used by the defense.
And so the defense uses this investigator, right, to testify about when the tickling occurred, whatever that phrase was.
Tickling the wire.
Yeah.
The expert who was the guy.
Yeah. I'm forgetting his name, Macklin or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Macklin was the investigator, and he described tickling the wire, which to me it's like the Battle of Midway where they sent out a phony message about the water desalination plant breaking down, and that's how they find out the Japanese are heading for Midway. Well, it's the same thing here, same principle, same theory. And I don't think Admiral Nimitz required a confirmatory memo before he sent three carriers out to meet the Japanese. So I...
Yeah, I mean, that's quite the analogy. But in this instance, though, I get, you know, what do you have against this guy? You have the fact that he makes the phone call, which is recorded, to Thurman after this December 9th roll call saying, stay away from Granny's house or whatever.
Granny's place, yeah.
Words to that effect. You have furnishing Thurman the bulletproof vest, as I recall.
Offering to do so.
Or offering to do so. And then is there a third?
Yes.
I feel like there's a third thing.
In connection with the robbery of Mr. Stingley, he was the competing drug dealer who was robbed of $5,000 in cash and a sizable quantity of heroin.
Oh, that's when he comes up with
right.
Thurman? Yeah.
Right, and then he comes up with phony arrest documents that he gives to Mr. Thurman. He being Mr. Wade does, is he gives them Mr. Thurman. And Mr. Thurman uses those to show to the victim of the robbery, I guess, Mr. Stingley, that, oh, this was a bona fide situation, and I was hauled away, and there really was a warrant for my arrest, so this wasn't pretextual. So,
one of the weird things about this whole case is that Mr. Thurman seems to be happily living out there on the street, being a drug dealer, for a really long time without getting arrested. So I can't quite figure that out.
Well, they were trying to build a case against him, and I think, you know, he was the original target, and this idea that the village of Maywood financed this is patently false. It was a state's attorney's investigation. And what happened was he approaches Officers Wheeler, Kobos, and I think Marquardt, and offers to bribe them, and they do the right thing, report it to the chief, and then they decide, well, as a bonus, maybe we can find out if this guy's bribing somebody else and expand the investigation.
Is there evidence in the record about the typical procedures followed in the Maywood Police Department for developing undercover contacts? Is this something that police officers just kind of go off and do on their own initiative? Is there some chain of reporting so that at least the chief has to know, or someone?
There are requirements that if one is going to establish someone as a police informant, in other words, a confidential informant, yes, there are rules and regulations with respect to that. There is training offered with respect to developing street sources, yes, training, but I'm not aware of any guidelines or rules, hard and fast, which say this is what you must do or must not do. But I think that, you know, to address some of the issues you raised with respect to the malicious prosecution claim, I'd only point out that is this court has noted that a malicious prosecution claim against a police officer in many ways is an anomaly because really, yeah, they may sign a complaint, show up to court, but who drives the prosecution bus? Not the police. And here, that was obviously the case. The officers did not sign any complaints. There's no evidence that they pressed the prosecution to move forward. Nothing like that at all. And this was something that was driven by the state's attorney. It was their investigation. They even had their own investigators. It was their wire room that was used, their equipment. So the idea that somehow he has a viable claim for malicious prosecution, forgetting a moment the whole issue of probable cause, he can't even satisfy the first element, which is instituting or commencing the proceedings. They did not do that. They didn't even testify before the grand jury. They testified at the trial, yes, but that's it. And I would submit that every time an officer testifies at trial, whether he's believed or not, that should not be a basis for him being held liable for prosecution.
No, there's immunity for that. There's no immunity for
right.
perjury, of course, in earlier stages. But
right. So I think that the district court's decision was correct and appropriate. The whole notion of similarly situated, there was no evidence of that. As we know, it was presented to the court, and I think the district court went through, I think, a rather difficult record to reach her decision. And I would simply point out that causation is something that they have to establish. I mean, as you know, Section 1983 is a species of tort liability, and as such, traditional tort principles apply. Here, there's no evidence of any causation at all that these guys caused this. And with respect to Enquist talks, as you noted, about prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutors do not have unlimited resources. Here, the lease resources are limited, and two prosecutors, veteran prosecutors, decided to move forward with this. No one on the defense side here made that decision. So as such, there's no personal participation or involvement in any alleged violation of Section 1983. So unless you have any other questions.
No, I don't think so.
I would ask that you please affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Horwitz, your time expired, so we will take this case under advisement.